So yeah, that was a nice introduction, just to add a bit more context. So I'm a linguist, and specifically I'm a discourse analyst. So I'm interested in how language primarily, but also other modes of communication like imagery and visuals, help to really construct and shape our social realities. And today I'm going to talk about some work that I've been doing looking at the language and images that we use when we talk about and communicate about dementia. I'm going to talk about this work because I think it provides a nice demonstration of the digital as method, but also the digital as data. So I'll get back to that idea shortly. Okay, it works. So I want to start with a bit of context about dementia itself. So dementia is a syndrome characterized by progressive deterioration in the brain. And this leads to symptoms like memory loss and problems with thinking and coordination. The term dementia doesn't refer to one specific disease. Many people would use it in that way, but it's actually an umbrella term, as sort of demonstrated by this visual from Kate Swaffer. So it's an umbrella term, and there are actually over 100 different types of dementia. And the most common type is Alzheimer's disease, which I think most people have heard of, but there are lots of other types too. Dementia is a major global public health challenge. So in the UK, which is the context that I live and work in, dementia currently affects around 900,000 people, but that figure is estimated to rise to 1.6 million people by the year 2040. There's presently no known cure for dementia. So it's a chronic condition, and that means that people who develop it and are diagnosed with it will eventually die with it as well. However, and importantly, for a point I'll make a bit later, while people die with dementia, they don't actually die of it. The most common cause of death in people with dementia is actually pneumonia. So the work I'm presenting today is from the public project called Public Discourses of Dementia. So the project's funded by UKRI, which is the main research funder in the UK, based at Lancaster University. There are two of us working on the project. I'm the one on the left, obviously. So I'm the PI, and I'm working with the brilliant Emma Putland, who's the senior research associate on the project. And in this work, we're exploring how dementia is represented across a wide range of contexts of public communication, focusing, as I've mentioned, on language and imagery. So we're looking at things like the news, social media, online support groups, public health campaigns, the language that charities use, and most recently we've been looking at generative AI, and that's something I'll talk about later in this session. Importantly, we're working with stakeholders from the media and from charities, and also people from public health, all with the aim of developing linguistically informed, context-sensitive guidance and training that we can provide to those different stakeholders to really help them to communicate about dementia in ways that reduce stigma and reduce the shame around it, but also promote some genuine awareness. Okay, so the first question I want to consider today to demonstrate kind of what some of the work we're doing looks like is, how is dementia represented in UK newspapers? And here I want to focus in particular on how newspapers use metaphorical language to talk about dementia. And in this work, I've drawn on, I guess, the digital as method, and specifically corpus linguistics. So corpus linguistics, for those, by show of hands, are people aware of corpus linguistics? Do people know? I'm curious. Who's heard of corpus linguistics? Or knows what it is? Oh, great. Okay, I can do this slide pretty quickly. There are still some that aren't initiated, but yeah. So corpus linguistics is essentially a collection of methods for studying linguistic patterns in very large collections of naturally occurring language use, or corpora. This language data is stored in a digital format, which means we can examine it using computer software. And because it relies on computer software in this way, corpus linguistics methods are quite well equipped to deal with very large data sets, digitized data sets, typically millions of words, sometimes billions of words. So a corpus is an electronic collection of naturally occurring texts which have been selected to be representative of a particular language or language variety. And the words I've highlighted here signal some of the main features of a corpus. I won't go into lots of detail about what corpora are now, but I can provide some further reading for those interested, but this is probably enough for you to understand the approach that we're taking. But essentially, when we're looking at corpora, and we're using corpus linguistic techniques, we're interested in patterns. We're interested in frequency, but we're interested in patterning. So things that happen a lot, or sometimes things that don't happen a lot, that run contrary to a pattern across a corpus, across a collection of texts. So, for the analysis that I'm talking about here, I compiled a corpus containing all UK national tabloid news articles mentioning either the word dementia or dementias once in their headline, and or three or more times throughout the article. I sampled articles over a period of 10 years, between 2010 and 2019, so that was 6,751 articles, which came to just under 4 million words of data. And the analytical approach that I took to identifying and interpreting the use of metaphor in this data was sort of a mixed methodology, which drew together techniques from corpus linguistics, as I've mentioned, but also frame analysis and critical discourse studies. So I started by using the corpus linguistic technique of collocation analysis to identify metaphorical patterns. Now, collocation is essentially the phenomenon where two words tend to occur together in very close textual proximity, and do so very often or with some frequency. And in this process, what happens is that words can become associated with each other in language users' minds, and these associations develop through exposure over time. And corpus linguistics techniques can help us to identify these kinds of patterns, these collocations, by searching for words that frequently occur together across large collections of text, across large corpora, like my corpus of news articles about dementia. And so in this study, I used collocation analysis to look at words that frequently occurred alongside the word dementia in the articles in order to identify frequent uses of metaphorical language. And there's a bit of technical information there at the bottom about how I did that. It's not so important, but for those who are interested, that's there. So having analysed those collocation patterns manually to identify metaphorical patterns, I interpreted those collocates, which did tend to be used metaphorically, in terms of the frames that they contributed towards. So here I draw on Goffman's notion of frames as organizing principles which help us to make sense of a thing and to represent it by foregrounding some elements and backgrounding others. So I was interested in the framing function that these metaphors performed. Through the framing analysis, I was able to group the metaphors according to the particular aspects of dementia that they represented. And these were dementia's prevalence, its causes, its symptoms and prognosis, the lived experience of dementia, and then responses to it. So how, as a society, we should deal with this challenge. And then my analysis, importantly, was also critical. So I wasn't interested in just describing these patterns, but I also wanted to interpret the metaphor and the their framing functions as being both constitutive of and constituted by their contexts. So I was interested in contexts of production, for example. So how the metaphorical framings might serve the commercial or ideological aims of the newspapers I was investigating. In terms of the broader socio-cultural context, I wanted to consider how the framings might reflect, but also shape societal experiences, understandings, and indeed actions in relation to dementia. I think a ghost has come in. Oh, it's left, okay. So on to some analysis. And beginning with dementia's prevalence, this was framed using metaphors belonging to a diverse range of domains, but all of them conveyed a sense in which the prevalence of dementia was high and also rising. So most frequently, the articles drew on a domain of sports and competition to frame dementia as the leading cause of death in the country. This was indicated in uses of collocates like leading, leader, overtaken, and overtook, which frequently occurred alongside the word dementia. For example, in this extract at the top, we see dementia is described as overtaking heart disease to become the leading cause of death. And it also knocks heart disease off the top of the table, like the Premier League of diseases or something. Violence metaphors were also used to frame dementia's prevalence, where its incidence could be quantified in terms of the number of people who'd been hit by it or what its death toll was. Related to the violence metaphor, dementia was also construed as a weapon, so a bomb or a time bomb, which I think foregrounds dementia's not only its rising prevalence, but also implies that this would continue to grow to disastrous effect. And dementia's growing prevalence was also rendered as an epidemic, and in around a fifth of cases as a silent epidemic. Now, at first glance, the use of that kind of language might not appear metaphorical because we talk about health problems as epidemics, but sort of belongs to the domain of illness. However, strictly speaking, the term epidemic actually denotes the spread of infectious diseases, which dementia certainly is not. And when we look at general language use, like Michaela did this morning, I consulted the British National Corpus and found that when we talk about epidemics, we usually do this to talk about some kind of negatively evaluated phenomenon, so things like crime or knife crime in particular, and the illegal use of drugs, things of that nature. So like the ticking time bomb metaphor, then the epidemic metaphor helps to provide that kind of negative evaluation of dementia prevalence. In terms of its causes, these could be framed using a domain of movement, with certain behaviours and risk factors being construed as speeding up the development of dementia. So we get collocates like accelerate, accelerated, and speeds. As well as focusing on the environmental risks associated with dementia, the newspapers also reported on certain biological factors, particularly protein variants and parts of the brain to which dementia onset had been attributed. So these risks could be framed in violent terms, where parts of the brain attack other parts of the brain. So a striking example of this is the notion of rogue cells, or the dementia dagger cell, which is a part of the brain which then attacks other parts of the brain to cause dementia. And as this bottom example shows, these kinds of creative uses of language aren't necessarily invented by the newspapers themselves, but sometimes they're intertextual or interdiscursive. They borrow them from other sources. In this case, it's from an academic journal article, so from the genre of science writing. So we're beginning to see a prevalence of violence and militaristic tropes, and this was particularly the case for how the newspapers framed dementia's symptoms and its prognosis. In these cases, dementia is anthropomorphized, so it's constructed almost as another social actor, and one which inflicts forms of violence on those who are diagnosed with it. So dementia could be construed as a thief which robs and steals people of their memories, their cognitive function, and even their personhood. Other symptoms are framed as forms of violence in more generic terms. So we get dementia described as something which ravages and strikes. In terms of the prognosis, the newspapers frequently foreground a fatalistic view of dementia. So they frame it as a murderer that kills people diagnosed with it. So essentially, if you get dementia, it's a death sentence. It will kill. And then this fatalistic framing is supported again by some kind of anthropomorphic characterization of dementia, which gives it qualities that imply it to be not only a violent actor, but one that inflicts violence willfully and deliberately. So we get words like brutally, cruel, cruelest, heartless, and savage. Consistent with the metaphorical framing of dementia as a cruel and brutal actor that inflicts violence, the lived experience of dementia could also be characterized in terms of conflict. So people with the condition are framed as battling, facing, and struggling with dementia. Other constructions were less agentive, though, on the part of people with dementia, so they don't even put up a struggle or a fight. In those cases, people could be described as victims or a victim of dementia, or being described as being in dementia's grip or hold without much resistance, or being struck by it passively. Meanwhile, the framing of people with dementia as succumbing or having succumbed to dementia arguably implies an initial struggle or resistance, but an eventual failure or even surrender, as we see in this example here. Another set of metaphors which similarly frames people with dementia as victims are found in stories which focus in particular on cases where they've been abandoned by their relatives. So in this case, we get people with dementia equated to kind of waste that's being disposed of. So we get people with dementia being described as being dumped in care homes, dumped in hospitals, in some cases dumped on the street. And the negative appraisal of life with dementia is also conveyed through metaphors which frame the experience of it in horrific or even apocalyptic terms. So we get life with dementia described as hell, a horror movie, a nightmare. And we also get more subtle kind of constructions in that same way through the collocate descent, which is a kind of spatial metaphor which constructs life as dementia with dementia as downward movement into the condition and draws on that broader association that we have of things going down being bad or getting worse. Not all metaphors necessarily imply this kind of negative outlook on life with dementia, though, or even foreground the victimhood of people diagnosed with it. And a particularly frequent kind of counterexample to that trend is the characterization of the relationship between dementia and the person with it as one of companionship. So this was indicated in uses of the collocates live and living. And this companionship metaphor, I think, is more flexible than those that I've described so far, because it could be used to describe the relationship that a person has with dementia in more or less harmonious terms, as these two examples show. So sometimes life with dementia is very difficult, but sometimes it's not that difficult, and dementia isn't the thing that defines a person's life, and the uses of these metaphors help to can help to convey that. And likewise, the metaphorical framing of dementia as a journey could be used to appraise life with the syndrome in more or less positive terms, as well as to foreground mixed experiences and dementia's progressive nature. So it's actually quite helpful from an awareness-raising perspective because the experience of the syndrome changes over time. Finally now, last set of metaphors, I promise. How do we respond to dementia society? What must we do? Well, the most pervasive metaphorical domain in this category was again violence. And here we see the response to dementia framed as a war or a battle or a mission against the syndrome. And this is one usually that the whole of society is involved in. And in the majority of cases, the key to victory in this war is the development of pharmacological interventions, so essentially a cure or some kind of drug. Relatedly, the promise of studies and pharmacological trials could be framed as having the potential to beat dementia in a race or to slow, stop, or reverse dementia's movement. While other metaphors imply that there is a cure for dementia somewhere out there in the world and that it exists, just has yet to be identified by scientists. So these scientists are undertaking a quest or a hunt or looking for clues to find the key to curing the syndrome. So although the vast majority of metaphors focused on biomedical response to dementia, so the development of drugs and curative treatments, in a small minority of cases, the articles focused instead on social care, so how we support people living with dementia in the here and now. And in this was particularly the case in the use of gambling metaphors. So we get the quality of social care critiqued in newspapers through gambling metaphors. So social care is a postcode lottery. So it varies a lot where you live, but it's a lottery. You don't know whether or not you'll get good care. Or even a Russian roulette regarding how well prepared your local hospitals are to deal with you if you have dementia. And again, that's also a violence metaphor because Russian roulette can be quite violent. So, this has been a bit of a whistle-stop tour of a wider programme of work, but I hope I've been able to illustrate some of the more prominent patterns in dementia press representation. So there are a wide range of tropes with the particular prominence of anthropomorphising metaphors, which equate dementia variously to a companion, a competitor, but most commonly actually to a violent killer. Almost all metaphors foreground the agency of dementia. This is something that came up earlier today, this question of agency, and I think it's particularly important here. In many cases, we see dementia anthropomorphized as a social actor, the disease as an actor. And those same metaphors background or preclude altogether the possibility that the person living with the syndrome can have agency in this process. As an agentive force, dementia moves and invades. It races against and hides from those seeking to cure it. And it competes with other conditions to become the leading cause of death in the country. People with dementia, meanwhile, are largely denied agency. They tend instead to be rendered as the target of violent actions, such as murder and theft. Now, a lot has been written about violence metaphors, and broadly they have the potential to stigmatize a disease or an illness or any health topic by framing those affected by it as the enemy of some kind of war. And their bodies are then rendered as metaphorical battlefields. And we saw this in how the press could frame the parts of the brain as attacking other parts of the brain, for example. A further issue with violence metaphors is that if the disease prevails and the person fails to recover, then those affected are often viewed as having lost that metaphorical battle. And in the case of dementia, as we don't have a cure, this is at present a battle that people will inevitably lose. But dementia stigma is not propagated just through metaphors of violence. We also saw the nightmarish scenarios, the apocalyptic scenarios, and lots of other patterns which broadly foreground dementia's most disastrous and fear-inducing aspects, while backgrounding, if not shutting down altogether, the possibility of living well with dementia, which actually many people do, as long as they have the right support around them. It's not all bad news, though. I know it's a bit doom and gloom, and the weather seems to have gotten darker since I started talking about this as well. Maybe it will get brighter when Mariana starts talking. But some of the metaphors might actually be more helpful in terms of reducing stigma and raising awareness. So those which frame the experience of dementia as a journey or which characterize it as companionship respectively articulate the progressive and chronic nature of the syndrome. But they could also be used more flexibly and foreground not only negative but also positive aspects of life for somebody experiencing dementia. And I think this is important because people living with this syndrome experience it differently, and no two days are the same. Okay, so the second part of my talk, which I promise is a lot shorter, don't we? Sabina getting scared on the front row. Yeah, it's much shorter. So having used digital methods to look at how newspapers talk about dementia, and I want to switch my focus to the digitalized data. And here I want to look at how AI-generated imagery might represent dementia visually. So I'm also flipping from the textual to the visual, or the linguistic, I should say, to the visual. And this is something I got interested in, as some dementia charities and advocacy groups that I've been collaborating with had indicated that generative AI tools could actually be really useful for them in terms of crafting and creating text. And so my instinct was to think about, okay, that's great for them in a practical sense, but how could this be used critically? And what, as a linguist and a discourse analyst, could I do to help them to get to that point? So for a bit of context, just as the invention of the printing press revolutionized the sharing of information through printed media, today, generative AI is increasingly influencing the ways in which we communicate. And here, what happens is that a user gives a textual prompt to an AI tool, and then that tool can generate text and also, in many cases, images in response. And it does this having been trained on a huge database of language and or, in this case, captioned images. Now, text-to-image generation is an increasingly accessible and popular way of creating visuals for professional text producers. For instance, stock image banks like Getty and Shutterstock are now offering users the option to generate their own images as well as to buy pre-made ones. So you don't just have to buy an image from Getty. You can say, these are all rubbish. I want one that does this. So get an AI tool to make you one that does just that. And this is significant, as image banks are a leading force in producing and disseminating visual representations of all kinds of social phenomena, including the kinds of images actually that we find in newspapers and other mass consumption texts. Now, many ethical debates currently surround AI and AI-generated imagery, and greater critical literacy is definitely needed at all levels. Increasingly realistic AI-generated images and videos risk worsening misinformation with potentially world-altering health, social, and political ramifications. And to exemplify that, I provided here a perhaps infamous example of a false image that did the rounds a couple of years ago of Donald Trump being arrested. And this was generated using an AI image generation tool. But it did the rounds on social media. Of course, because of the High Court judgment, we know that this isn't actually possible, so it must be a false image. AI bias is another central concern. So research has shown that AI can not only reflect, but actually amplify pre-existing human stereotypes in terms of how it represents individuals from particular backgrounds. So at the bottom of this slide here, I've included a couple of examples from a study carried out by Bianchi and colleagues, where what they did was they typed in words like poor into an AI image generation tool, and they found that the word poor was particularly likely to elicit images of black people, while the word attractive tended to elicit images of white people. Meanwhile, occupations, they also found, were gendered, with roles like software engineer being associated with men and housekeeper being associated with women. And the same can be said for other kinds of bias as well. So Bianchi and colleagues found persistent visual stereotypes when they searched across different tools. They found even that altering the text prompt to generate less oppressive imagery often didn't mitigate racist, sexist, and ableist biases. And again, these biases often intersected with one another. So for example, the authors found that typing in a blonde woman leading a meeting worked. Okay, great. It wasn't just men leading a meeting, and even blonde women could lead a meeting in an AI image tool. Fantastic. But if they replace the word blonde with the word disabled, then the visually disabled woman in the image is shown instead listening to another woman leading the meeting rather than actually leading that meeting herself. So there's something happening algorithmically, which means that these tools essentially can't generate an image of a woman in a wheelchair leading a meeting. And that's because the online data that these tools are trained on simply don't have enough of those kinds of representations out there in the world for these tools to draw from and use when they're creating imagery. Okay, so what we wanted to do in our analysis was to see whether certain kinds of bias or stigma around dementia would also emerge if we use this kind of tool to create images of people with dementia. And for this, we used a tool called Stable Diffusion. And using this tool, we created 171 images using the simple prompt dementia. We kept it very simple. I've also displayed some of the settings that we used to create the images here in case people are interested. This isn't really my bag. That's something that one of my collaborators did. He's into this and he understands it in industry practices. I don't really. I'm coming at it as a fairly naive discourse analyst. But looking at the images generated, we were first of all interested in who was shown as having dementia. And there were clear stereotypes in this regard. Notably, the person was shown to have dementia tends overwhelmingly to be white, with clear signs of older age. That's very visible. For example, having visible wrinkles and white hair. But this sort of ignores the reality of the many people living with early onset dementia, which can actually start in your 40s and sometimes even in your 30s. There's a similar lack of diversity in the characteristics attributed to those individuals who tended overwhelmingly to be shown alone, in isolation, and in passive and immobile poses, with expressions or gestures conveying sadness, suffering, or a sense even of being vacant. These figures also tend to be set against empty backgrounds that provide little to no context about the individuals. And they also tend to look off camera or have their eyes closed even. And I've indicated it in these cases using arrows and crosses. So arrows show the direction of the eye gaze, and a cross shows where people have their eyes closed. Now, I'd argue that this distinct lack of eye contact mimics real life in that not looking towards the viewer encourages viewers to observe these individuals rather than to seek to connect with them as individuals or even on an emotional level. So these kinds of averted gazes help instead to create a sense of social distance between us as the viewers and the represented participants, i.e. the people with dementia. The main way that people living with dementia are contextualized when that happens is through their brains and certain neural processes, which are presented in these cases as being abnormal. So in foregrounding this biological, even neurological focus, the images again necessarily background the individual. There's no possibility for an even simulated life or kind of life world beyond the defective brain and any non-medical aspects of life with dementia, for that matter. Instead, the people are reduced to their brains and to neurological processes, and faulty ones at that. A number of the images show dementia metaphorically. Don't worry, I won't bang on about metaphor for too much longer, but using visual metaphors of a tree. And trees are widely regarded as a symbol of life and an image of seasonal change. Thank you, Sabina, that's perfect. Here, then, it's notable that these trees are consistently bare when they're shown in context of dementia. Elsewhere, the lost leaves for these bare trees have been associated with lost brain cells, lost memories, or even a loss of personal qualities. This notion of dementia as a tree is quite a common trope, but it's interesting to see these tools reproduce it here. So if the life cycle can be regarded as a metaphorical seasonal cycle, with spring as birth, and then these bare trees signal a personal winter for the person living with dementia. And of course, that's a season widely associated with bleakness and death. And this living death connotation, I'd argue, is enhanced by the dullness and blandness and lifelessness of the colour palette here. So we tend to see that it favours blues, beiges, greys and blacks over more vibrant colours. Okay, so in summary, the AI generated images reproduce the kinds of stereotypes of people living with dementia that we've observed earlier, including in the kinds of news texts that I showed you earlier in this talk. And I'd argue that these kinds of depictions can therefore draw on and reinforce the stigma and shame that currently surrounds dementia. So there's clear evidence that the images generated by tools like Stable Diffusion reproduce existing discourses and existing stereotypes. In this case, they emphasize old age, the faultiness and fragmentation of people's minds and brains. And they focus on loss of abilities and loss of self. Suffering is also emphasized, and people with dementia are distanced from others throughout. Taken together, these patterns contribute to a sense of deathliness and reproduce the metaphorical trope that people with that dementia and people with dementia are the living dead. And importantly, I've highlighted the word reproduce here, as these images don't construct new visual discourses, but simply reproduce or even recycle precisely the kinds of representations that surround dementia on the data on which these tools are trained. Such representations are, of course, partial. They offer just one way of looking at dementia. And on the other hand, there's a distinct lack of consideration here for individuals' unique personalities. And the focus on deficit and what is lost leads to a lack of attention on what kinds of abilities might remain following a dementia diagnosis. There are other, perhaps more productive and life-affirming ways of looking at dementia, or discourses around it, that aren't really visible at all in AI-generated data. And that's also true for linguistic textual data that I've generated using these tools in other projects. Instead, what could be possible is foregrounding the diversity of people who have dementia, or fostering a sense of connectedness, or the sense that life can continue after a dementia diagnosis. Thank you. That people aren't reduced to their suffering, and that dementia can help them to critically reflect on existing social norms and allow us to do that as a society and to reflect on existing discourses. These opportunities are lost. Now, at this point, it's important to recognize that there were some exceptions to the overall trends I've talked about. For instance, a few of the AI-generated images, three of which I've put on this slide, provide alternative portrayals that instead emphasize connection and activity, and so overall suggest the potential for more diverse representation. And to end on a more hopeful note, I realize this has been such a bleak talk, I'm so sorry everyone, goodness. As academics, and I think as a society as a whole, there's scope for us to explore how tools like generative AI tools, like Stable Diffusion, can be used for human good in the future. However, I think right now this needs some working out, and it certainly requires some change. Indeed, generative AI is continuously developing, and the kind of work I've presented here aims to be part of a broader critical conversation that highlights the socio-political effects of such emerging technologies and the kind of emerging genres that they bring with them. Whether we like it or not, it seems like generative AI certainly isn't going anywhere, so as a society, I think it's imperative that we better understand the implications of using it. And as researchers in humanities disciplines and as socially oriented researchers in general, we have a key role to play in this. as well in general as working towards the development of more inclusive, ethical, and importantly, critical approaches to envisioning, training, and using these kinds of tools in the future. And here I can just about stop. So there are just some references from the work that I've talked about today. And if you're interested more in corpus linguistics and how it can be used to look at health topics and the health humanities broadly, this book I recently authored with Luke Collins provides a lot of context on the approach. And so there I can stop. Thank you for listening.